We're first going to hear from Teresa Rayford. Welcome to KABU. Teresa Rayford?
Are you able to hear me?
Ah, yes. Teresa, welcome to KABU.
Well, thank you, and I guess it's a welcome back.
That's right. I've heard you've been on a few times, and that's why we have you again today. Teresa Rayford is a leader in Don't Shoot Oregon, other social justice organizations, putting the pressure on for what the establishment media calls criminal justice, quote, reform. In fact, reform is a real misnomer. In fact, it has to be a complete transformation of the police, the sentencing systems, the treatment of prisoners, the responsibilities of judges and prosecuted attorneys, among many, many other things. Teresa, you're right now on the road to Salem, going to meet with prison officials at the state penitentiary. Tell us briefly, what are you going to be talking to them about?
Well, basically, we're looking at a couple of different issues that are happening out there around prisoner safety during the transfer process. Also, the accommodations inside when there's different issues as far as protests, riots, and, different extreme situations and their ability to be able to speak out. We're just going out there, hopefully, to have a meeting to start opening up the conversation around these things, and what can we do to help with building their access to their rights.
Right. You're also, I understand, starting a conversation about the cuts in funding and the way in which they're dealing with them, which is to cut all of the prison programs that, in fact, are really necessary for people to live there in with some sort of sense of hope and things to do.
Absolutely, because their right to freedom of expression and access to education, a lot of that is playing into some of the discrepancies that are happening out there in regards to their safety, their access to these programs. I was out there on Saturday, and I got to watch a play that was produced called The Bucket, and it was, the person that's bringing it out there, this brother Phil, they've been doing this for about 9 years throughout institutions across the country, but they have limited access to funds, and then they have to deal with the bureaucracy within the inside. But what's happening is that by bringing this art programming in there, what it's doing is just helping the prisoners not only have a different type of peace of mind where they're avoiding, situations like solitary confinement, or the destruction and, of what happens when you go into the wards for the hospital care. But they're able to start using restorative justice techniques and different tools to accommodate the support of these programs, and it's changing the culture within. But if we're looking at defunding these programs or not having them have access to it, it's another step backwards. So one of the things that I'm doing now is just going out there really to try to advocate for this because, I'm in the car now with Matt from the ACLU. Being incarcerated, when they first created penitentiaries, it was for penance, and we thought that it was going to be a situation for rehabilitation. But without programming that basically keeps you connected to the outside world or keeps you thinking critically or keeps you being creative, we're basically going to be facing people that are coming out of this system that have no that are numb to what's happening out here, that have a different reality. And what we see is recidivism when people return back because they feel like they can't adjust to what's happening. So we're saying that having these programming and making sure that education is available, that is a human right. And it doesn't only benefit those on the inside. It also benefits us and their families when they come outside to regular society.
Right, right. We talked about recidivism. It's also, of course, because not only do people become often hardened and lose sight of important values in prison, they also often face huge fines. They cannot get jobs. Their past follows them forever. Proclaiming your innocence or does you no good at all, you can't vote, all of those things. There are so many attacks, there are so many burdens that people who have been in jail face. That's also part of the story of recidivism, I understand. There's so much wrong with prisons, the violence that's encouraged often. The guards do it and they encourage it. The solitary confinement, health system, the food, I'd like to talk about today, though, just for a few minutes, your project with the Lewis and Clark Law School with regard to who goes to jail and how it happens and whether there are appeals and the power of prosecutors. Tell us about that issue.
Okay. Yeah, well, this past weekend, I connected with Corinne Fletcher, who is a Lewis and Clark law student, and also just working with all these other students. I think there might have been about 13 of them. But they're working with students in McLaren, with the youth in McLaren, to kind of identify ways to avoid the mandatory sentencing and the Measure 11 crimes. They're looking at different trends that not only occurred maybe in the school system, but also with the community partnerships that were relative to the policing issues that determined that incarceration was going to be the next step for some of these at-risk youth. And if you notice, there is a trend in communities of poverty. There's a direct line through the education system that gets those children into our incarcerated institutions. So working with those youth, you're able to stand right there with them before they're going into the Department of Corrections to kind of evaluate how exactly did you get here. You know, one of the questions that I asked during a group conversation with the teens this past weekend was, when was the first time that somebody told you were bad? And they were like, what? And everybody responded, like, basically school and all this. And I was like, whoa, really? A place where you go to learn and be educated and kind of consider what words mean and what actions mean and what you can do instead of instructing a child into doing different things. We identified them as being certain things. And then we connect that identity with who they are. So black children in Portland, if they live in North and Northeast Portland, no one's looking at their economic status. They're looking at the color of their skin, and they're saying that they're at risk or disadvantaged. And right. I had a lot of children that were saying to me, like, what does that mean? You know, they had no idea that that was systemic language that was basically identifying where their positioning in society was and, you know, to the detriment.
Teresa,